do so more and more. We finally get to one of the points of Paul's letter, one of the reasons he's writing this letter. We've had 3 whole weeks of gushing and love and pride, and now we get to the heart of the matter, the reason why Paul is worried about this young congregation. He wants them to remember that God's teaching is supposed to change their lives, and he wants them not to backslide, more or less. And we see from this part of the letter that Paul is above all, I think, a pragmatist. He is above all a pragmatist because he knows that there are vast implications for what he's trying to teach them about the nature of God and about the nature of them, each of them as God's beloved creation and as each of them as a community of faith, as a part of a community of faith. But he starts with the basics. He starts with some rather harsh basics. Don't sleep around. Don't cheat other people. Don't disrespect other people. That's what it really comes down to, I think, here. He calls it love, but I think we would call it respect. And it's respect in 2 very basic ways. Paul is reminding them to respect themselves and to respect each other. Right? That's basically it. You might call it the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Why is it so hard? Well, they'd never been taught that way. But the real reason it was so hard then is the same reason it's challenging even today. It's that there are values in the wider community, the wider culture, that are different from the values that Paul is teaching them through Jesus Christ. There are values in our wider community, in our wider culture, that are different from the values that we try to practice as disciples of Christ. They're not always the same thing. Fortunately, in our context, they are more similar than they were in Thessaloniki. There are some things in our culture that I think help us behave as Christians. But there are still some things that distract us from that. And even more so back then. What's this respect look like? Well, I think it's rooted in the very first chapter of the Bible. We were created in God's image. God created us in God's image and called us good. Actually called us very good. But sometimes you and I, we don't believe it. We don't believe it. We don't live that way. I mean, this is even before we figure out if other people are made in God's image. Many of us have a hard time recognizing and living like we are created in God's image. Because, you know, those people that do the things that Paul mentions right off the bat, well, we can say, well, boy, they don't respect other people. I mean, they're cheating them out of their money and they're using them for... But I got news for you. They don't respect themselves either. They don't believe that they're good enough. They don't believe they're worthy enough. They don't believe that they can put in an honest day's work and make a living. They don't believe they can enter honestly into a romantic relationship and find fulfillment there. They don't believe they're worthy of it. They don't respect themselves enough, so they find it impossible to respect everyone else around them. And that is still present in our culture. It's still present in our politics and in our laws. We always are taught, I think, to look out for number one, right? Because who else is going to look out for you? If you don't do it, nobody else is going to. So we look out for number one. When I was in fourth grade, my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Miller, when we would do our spelling tests every week, she allowed us each week to pick out extra words to add to our spelling list. She would have words for us, but then we could pick extra words to put on our list. And I'll be honest, all these years later, I only remember one word that I added to my fourth grade list, but it was a doozy. Machiavellian. Machiavellian. The Italian writer Niccolai Machiavelli, famous for writing The Prince. Machiavelli, oh dear. M-A-C-H-I-A-V-E-L-L-I-A-N, I believe, is Machiavellian. you know, I don't remember if I actually spelled it right that week. I just remember that I put it on the list. Why do I mention that this day? I think that Machiavelli's writing on political philosophy is the highest form of dog-eat-dog, watching out for number one that's ever been written. He writes in The Prince, and he says, the prince foremost must do one thing, stay in power, have whatever it takes. If things are going smoothly and the prince can love everybody and be generous and let everybody do a lot of things, so much the better. But if things start falling apart and the prince has to crack down, the prince does whatever it takes to survive in power. And that is how you and I are raised in this culture even today. We have to do whatever it takes to make it through. Don't believe me? Well, watch a Western. Don't believe me? Watch a recent Liam Neeson movie. That seems to be the theme of all of his recent movies. Taken, Kidnapped, whatever they're calling, you know, Taken 18, whatever we're up to now. That poor daughter and wife of his character, I don't know. I mean, they've been through so much. And he will do, you know, I don't know if you know the story of that movie. It's a joke. They've made several of them now. Somebody in his family gets kidnapped, and he does whatever it takes to save them. Because he's looking out for his family, and number one. His motivations are not love, charity, or forgiveness. Whatever it takes. And we're taught that, you know, whatever it takes to get a job and to keep a job. Whatever it takes to keep the family going, to keep the roof over your heads and the food in the cabinet and the medicines in the medicine cabinet. Whatever it takes. Which is fine and good up to a point. As long as we recognize that is not Christ's way. I'm not saying it's bad. I don't think we can avoid it. But it's not Christ's way. Long before Machiavelli and some of his compatriots in the early 16th century wrote their political philosophy about such things, a very famous theologian named Augustine wrote about the nature of Christian love. I'm going to paraphrase because Augustine gets ridiculously technical in his theology. But he talks about two kinds of love. He talks about the kind of love that most people in the world describe and the type of love we're supposed to have as Christians. And it boils down to this. Most people in the world, when they say they love someone, or we might add something, they don't love it as it is. They love it for what it can do for them. Does that make sense? They love people not because they're so good at X, Y, and Z, but because they're so good to be around. They do so much for me. They take care of me. They cook for me. I look good when I'm standing next to them. They're fun to be around. They have lots of money. You know, whatever. We look to use people and things, and we call it love. And Augustine writes, love, Christian love, true love, those are all synonyms, by the way, regardless of how the world says it, true love values the other person as another human being, or values the other thing as another thing that has its own integrity and its own worth. Yeah, we like to be around them, but not because we get stuff from them, but because we appreciate them for who they are and they appreciate us for who we are. And to use more modern language, Augustine never says this, and he'd probably disagree because that's the kind of theologian he was. He'd always find mistakes in your thinking. But I think we would say, when we're around him and they're around us, we become better people because of it. That's more the nature of Christian love. Why? Because we're respecting ourselves as created in God's image, and we're respecting other people as created in God's image. But it's hard. It's hard because we can't do that full time in this world. Because however much that works, even in a Christian nation like our own, there's still a dog-eat-dog part of our life that we just can't avoid entirely. I've spent the past week at camp, and the one repetitive thing I hear year after year, particularly with the high school students at camp, is this: they wish that the world could be more like camp. Right? They wish that, or more often they say, they wish that the real world could be more like camp. Now, I like to suggest it's all the real world, but that aside, I think I understand what they're saying. Some of it is escapism, like when you and I go on vacation. They're away from their headaches and their problems, and they get to avoid some stuff, like we do. But I don't think that's really what they're talking about. I think for a week they get to break out of the rut of their relationships and be in relationships more like they want to be. In fact, I think it's the same way we act when we're at church as opposed to when we're out of it. Sometimes we ministers poo-poo and say, well, that's because people try to put on their Sunday face. You know, we all try to act a good game and behave appropriately on Sunday morning, but that's not truly us, and we become more truly us out there. That's sometimes true, but I think it's also the case that when we come together, we don't have to behave like we've learned to behave outside of these walls. Because in school or in your workplace, do you start out by behaving as a Christian, or do you try to fit in the group however you can, whatever it takes to get through the day? Right? So do you pick on other people because they're all making jokes about that person, and as long as you join in and make jokes about them, they're not going to make jokes about you? And we talk about that a lot with kids in school, but it happens at all ages. We work into our families and into our classrooms and into our jobs and into our communities, and we find a role that we can survive. And that's how we live. It's not truly who we are, and it's not who God created us to be, but it's how we get through the day. It's how we look out for number one. And hopefully, at our best, as imperfect as churches are, at our best, we offer a break from that. We say, this is not God's way. There is another way. And so, yes, in some ways, we should behave differently when we're here. Not because we're trying to put on an act, but because we're trying to behave like we know God wants us to behave, and we feel safe doing it here. We feel like people aren't going to gang up on us and turn us into the whipping boy and the whipping girl. That we're not going to be the butt of everybody's jokes. That we're going to be valued. That we're going to be respected. That we're going to be loved. Paul makes this dichotomy in this first part of chapter 4. There's a wider culture and there's the church. And we've got to learn how to try to live as Christians in both of them. We've got to learn how to live with respect for everyone around us. For the other Christians, for the lapsed Christians, for the non-Christians. Because all of them, just like you and I, are made in God's image. And because all of them, just like you and I, are loved equally by God. That's why we do it. We don't have to prove that they're worthy of respect. God has proven that you and me and everybody else is worthy of that respect. And then, when we can break out of those routines, when we can break out of some of those bad habits, when we don't always have to worry about being number one, we don't always have to worry about fighting off other people, when we come together as a Christian community, maybe we can just love all the more and appreciate each other all the more, and encourage one another all the more, and pick each other up when we make mistakes all the more, rather than kicking them when they're down. Because as long as they're down, it's easier to step on top of them and move along on your path. I know sometimes some of the lessons in the Bible seem obscure and really old-fashioned. And a handful of them are. But this one, sadly, unavoidably, is very true in our lives today. The one thing, as I will say last week, is that we are blessed. We have it easier than some people who came before us, and from some people who live in other places in the world today. We do live in a country that was founded mostly by people who were Christians. Governments are not the same as churches. I don't think they can be. They have different roles. They do different things. So just because it is a Christian country doesn't mean that we all just naturally live as Christians in it. That's still what the church is for. In fact, if I might add a related note, I think that's one of the brilliant insights of our founders in organizing this country. I don't know if you realize it, but they recognized that the government could not do everything for everybody, could not create equal opportunities for everybody. So what they did was they created a system that encouraged and allowed other groups to pick up the slack. And foremost in their minds for who would do that were churches. That's one of the reasons why there's freedom of religion in this country, so that the churches can make sure that the Christian ideals get lived out in this country, because the government can't always do that. Today, what are we supposed to do so more and more? How are we supposed to love our neighbors more and more? How are we supposed to love each other more and more? Well, we love each other in this room more and more by being able to freely gather and freely share and freely be ourselves with each other. But in this country, how do we love others more and more who are outside these walls? We make sure they're not left out. We make sure that it's not only certain people who get medical care or enough food or housing. We look for the holes and we try to fill them. We look at education, and we see what's being taught, and we look for the holes in it, and we try to fill them. We look at the arts, and try to see where there's not enough art, and we try to fill that hole too. It's not only a Christian thing, mind you. There's lots of other people that do that too. But that was always the hope, I think, of our founders. The recognition that the government couldn't do it all, because the government wouldn't see it all. And if it could see it all, it would stomp on far too many people trying to do anything. So they created a system where hopefully we would have the freedom to reach out as Christians, so that beyond being a Christian nation in the structure of government, we could be a Christian nation as much as possible in practice. But that falls on churches. It falls on the members of churches. It falls on you and me to live like that. But that's not so different as it was 2,000 years ago, or as it has ever been. That's why Paul is so amazingly brilliant, that he was able to look into his time and place and write with wisdom through God's Spirit that speaks across the ages, including a very real part of our lives today. And he doesn't stop there. Next week, we're going to talk about a big question that the Thessalonian church gave to Timothy that Paul answers. And it's a question you might have asked once or twice. What happens when people die? We'll talk a little bit about that next Sunday. All right? Amen.